Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
East Timor, what's wrong? Thanks to callers for the use of this fire facility tonight. We have two speakers, Paul Keeley. Maybe we have three speakers. We have Paul Keeley, which is author of Shakedown, and Jenny Crumby's got some copies of Shakedown at the back. Piper is Australia's grant for Timor Oil. And Paul is an author and journalist, and writes occasionally these days at the Australian Financial Review. His main task these days is full-time writing. He's currently writing a book on Australia's involvement during the Second World War in Portuguese and Dutch Timor. This is Paul's first address to the Sydney Institute. Frank Brennan makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Of course, he's an author and commentator, professor of law at the Australian Catholic University, a visiting professor at the University of New South Wales, and he was director of the Jesuit Refugee Services in East Timor from 2000 until 2001. So thanks to both our speakers, and Jenna Crundy's also got some copies of Frank's earlier books on politics and conscience and a book on asylum seekers down the back. So we'll lead off with Paul Cleary, followed with Frank Brennan, then we'll go to questions and discussion, finish no later than 7 o'clock. Thank you, Paul. You may want to okay.
Thank you very much to Anne and to Jared for inviting us along tonight. Thanks to all of you for coming and for your interest in Timor. I thought I'd begin by talking about one aspect of society in Timor, which I can safely say that I know very well, and that is the village in which I lived when I was based in Timor permanently from 2003 till the end of 2005, and I've since been back three times to do further research on the new book, so I can talk about more up-to-date events. This is Timor, as you can see. I mean, I might just switch off the lights, if that's possible, to switch over the front there. This is Timor, as it's probably best known, wedged in between Australia and the Indonesian archipelago. And if you just zoom down, that's Dili, the capital, and quite a big sprawling city to the east and west, and that's because there's a big mountain range here, which I'll come to later, and this is the Comoro River, the international airport. Just getting a bit closer in. Essentially, Dili is interesting. 30 years ago, it was a very tiny city, probably about this big, but it's really sprawled in Indonesian times and also since independence. And in talking about my village, it's an interesting part of Timor. As I said, it's right up against the mountain. So you can see it actually going along here. It just sort of follows that sort of, just the foothill there. And then going further in, this is an interesting point. This here is the UN compound of 1999. You might remember where people were, thousands of people fled the militia rampage and ended up there, and many of them climbed over the walls and went up into the mountain. And this river here is interesting. That's a sort of a secret back door of Dili, and a lot of people used that in 1999 to escape rather than using the main road. The village actually takes its name from the abattoir, which was based there during the Portuguese time, and that's it right there. So that's why it's called Matadouro. And essentially, when I lived there, it was a very peaceful place. I say it was a village because, like anywhere in Timor, it had a village chief, it had chiefs of sub-villages, it had a community centre. It was a real community. And I thought I might just start by talking about one of the most basic necessities of life and to give you a bit of an insight into what life was like in this village. This is actually the main street, Matadouro Road. And these children are doing essentially the key afternoon chore of most people most young children in Dili, in Timor and in Dili, and that is to carry water, because most people don't have running water. And so, and they can, nor can they afford to drill down into the bore underneath the city to get the bore water. So most children do this, and there's actually a pipe which came down from the mountain, which I just showed you, and there's a tap sort of a bit further up here, and people would go and fill up these water bottles, and then they would carry them home after school. That didn't actually work for all the year, because there's a wet and dry season in Timor, and so in the dry season that tap would actually run dry. And so this is people actually having to go further up into the river valley and to get these buckets of water and to carry it home. And so this is people with their carts. The men were very keen on building these carts. And here are some more proud owners of one of those water carts of an afternoon in Dili. The lack of clean water in Timor was actually something that contributes to having some of the worst health indicators found anywhere in the world, particularly for children. Something like 12% of children don't make it to their fifth birthday. 40% suffer the effects of undernutrition through being stunted in their growth. And this is really all partly to do with calories, but it's also to do with poor sanitation. The other thing that Matadoro really wanted for, like most of Timor, another basic thing, was work. And it's here in this village that actually right opposite my house, these are courtesy of Google Earth, of course, there's a big banyan tree just there. And unfortunately, I never got a good shot of it, but this is the here, and you can probably see, you might see these tyres that are sort of wedged into the ground. And this is where many of the young people in the afternoon would congregate, and they would basically spend the whole day there, and essentially they were there all day and into the evening playing the guitar because they were unemployed. And many of them were in their 20s, and at the time where they might want to be getting married, because in Timor that people get married very young. And you could sense the frustration when you speak to these young men about just how difficult life was, because you'd ask them if they'd ever worked and they'd look at you blankly and they would never have a job. Some of them had jobs as security guards during the UN time, but pretty much it was a lot of unemployment. Despite all this, it wasn't a totally bleak place. In fact, I found this village just a wonderful place to live. I'd often do my afternoon run up the road into the river valley. And here's someone who did have a job, taxi driver, washing his car in the morning. And but it wasn't actually a totally depressing place, but this is really what it's all about in terms of looking at the overall picture. It's a very young population in Timor. This is the population pyramid, and the country doesn't actually have the population bulge that you find with the baby boomers. And that's because of two reasons. One is that the life expectancy is only 55, and that many people were killed. Estimates range from around 200,000 during the Indonesian times, and most of those were the older people. So you can see that most of the population is sort of under the age of 20, well over half under the age of 24, so very, very young population. Having said that, even though it was a tough place, this is a typical scene at Christmas, people building these nativity scenes. So there was a sense of community there, people just doing these things of their own volition, trying to make their community an interesting place in which to live. You might be wondering now, well, why was it so difficult in Timor? Hasn't the country got a lot of oil? That's what we've been all hearing about in the last few years. And I guess the answer to that question is both yes and no, and it depends on what time period you're talking about. When Timor was first independent, it actually didn't have a lot of money. And if you think about it, the challenges were, I think, pretty formidable. And in 1999, the country really was starting from way behind, and after independence in 2000, that there was pretty much the loss of the country's infrastructure. The whole public administration basically packed up and went back to Indonesia. As I said, very limited financial resources of about $80 million a year to run all of the services, introducing a new language, quite a difficult cultural mix as well. The exiles who had lived in Mozambique and spoke Portuguese, and the youth who actually didn't speak Portuguese at all and mainly spoke Indonesian. And as an example of the vacuum of public administration. I mean, for example, the medical service, you'd go to districts at the time and you'd find that you'd meet the doctor for a district of 60,000 people. Later on, however, the country did get more money and there was the capacity to do things, and unfortunately it didn't happen. And this was at a really critical time, I think in 2005. And the reason why it didn't happen was, as I said, the lack of basic administrative capacity just to roll out programs to basically spend the money that's there in the budget. As the oil revenue flowed in 2005, there was an opportunity to increase the budget quite dramatically, and it should have happened, but it wasn't actually realised. And the other reason why the government struggled, I think, and this really brings us to where we are now, is it was a very centralised administration. It was a government that essentially was all power, all decision-making centralised in Dili. And so a lot of decisions actually didn't get made. Ministers were travelling a lot. One area of the budget they were able to spend fully was actually air travel. I have a chapter in my book called Animal Farm, which I think sort of says a lot about the leadership style. So this was really a reflection, I think, of the time that a lot of the leadership had spent, particularly the Prime Minister, Mr. Alfatieri, had spent in Mozambique. And the Portuguese author, Pedro Mendes, who spent a lot of time in Angola, Mozambique, and is now a correspondent in Dili, made the point that in places like Mozambique, very much the mentality is all about centralisation. So I think this is one of the problems that the Timor government got into. There was also this sense that you couldn't really splash money around, that people would have a dependency mentality if you did that. There was a few sort of quite unfortunate ideas about the Timorese. So in the first few years after independence, this is what happened. This is the UN period. Now, these are GDP numbers, fraught with a lot of difficulty, sort of taken with a grain of salt, but I'll come to something else which is more telling. But this indicates that you've got 5 years of the economy going backwards. It's something like, you know, being in a Great Depression type situation. But what's more interesting, if you look at these are imports, which are much more easy to measure because they all come through the docks in Dili. And so that's showing from 2002, in step with this fall in GDP, that you've got imports coming down. Now, the main thing that you import in Timor is food and fuel, not really luxuries like we do. And there was a newspaper report in 2005 saying that people were dying of starvation. And the Prime Minister at the time got very angry, and he actually cancelled the government subscription to that newspaper and banned those journalists from all press conferences. But those figures, I tend to think, indicate that maybe there was some truth to those reports, that there were people actually dying of starvation. Because essentially what you had in Timor was a country that wasn't monetized. I mean, outside Dili, there really wasn't much of an economy. And this is why what tended to happen was that young people would basically start moving into the city, and the population really began to expand in after 2002. And adding to that, you had a lot of contested ownership over land. A lot of people moved into former houses of Indonesian public servants who had left. And so as a result of that, there was a lot of potential. So it's my view that it's really these economic factors that are essentially the backdrop to the crisis of 2006 and what we're dealing with now. But on top of that, and I guess what the fuse that lit the powder keg being the economy, but the fuse was this mismanagement of the armed forces dispute, which you probably all know about and read about, which in my view really shouldn't have happened. But to me it sort of reflected a lot of that hubris and autocracy that was in that decision to ban the newspaper. You know, the idea that you could actually sack almost half the army and that it actually wouldn't create instability. The former Prime Minister, Mr. Alfatieri, who I worked for, said in these famous last words after the sacking of the soldiers, "The government is in control of the situation. The party presently in charge is a big party and therefore has the power to go to the base and control the situation." Now, what happened in Matadoro was there were houses burnt, probably about half a dozen from my little look around in a couple of visits. Wasn't really a lot of rhyme or reason as to why. One house that was burnt was a couple, one from the west, one from the east. But essentially, it seemed to be people who were more affluent. So I guess maybe a lot of envy, people sitting around, nothing to do, no money, deciding to go and pick on someone who actually got a few cars in their driveway, which seemed to be what happened. In February last year, after the Australian Army intervened and tried to hunt down the rebel leader, Renato, who, by the way, at this time had become a very popular figure in my village, and that actually, when I went back there in 2006, there were all these this graffiti on the walls, Viva Renato. So he's a man who was killed last month in an attempt on the life of the president. So an outlet for all this frustration of these young people was to get behind this quite crazy rebel leader, and they were all very keen on him. And in February last year, after the Australian Army tried to hunt him down and killed five of his men, there were riots everywhere, including in Matadoro. And the people who actually then moved into my house had to get rescued by the Portuguese Republican National Guard, who came along in a van and then actually went back and came back in a armoured personnel carrier in order to do the job properly, because it was just a bit of a hot situation. Tragically, though, the person who owned my house was a very lovely man from Flores Island. After hearing the news that his house was then trashed, actually died of a heart attack. The circuit breaker for all of this was the elections last year. And I think that actually says a lot about Timor, even though it's a new country and there's a lot of immaturity there, that the country was able to hold elections which were fairly, pretty much incident-free. And there was a very correct and bloodless handover of power, which I think actually says a lot about the country and its potential, that because in a lot of other countries that may not have been the case, particularly in a post-conflict situation. But one of the concerns about that election result, if you sort of look at some of the east-west results, and what you've got is a real polarisation. So this tiny little dispute in the armed forces really created out of nothing, because the officers in the armed forces were from the east, the men who felt they had been discriminated against were from the west, and now you've got this huge polarisation of the entire country. So these are some of the easternmost provinces, and you can see the vote for Fretland, very strong, and for the new party, which was set up by the Prime Minister, Mr. Gujnal, it's very low. But it's actually the opposite in some of the key westernmost parts of the country. So you do have a real polarisation, which I think is a concern. Recently on a trip last year, I was in the province of Bekeke, which is 62% in favour of Fretland. And this is the sort of stuff you'd see. This is in Tetu. And it basically says that we don't accept the decision of the president, which doesn't represent the... He doesn't have the majority of the people. So there is this really strong feeling of this people in that area not accepting the government. This is a roadblock. You can see they've cut down this big tree. It's actually been moved, but dragging these big trees across the road to basically say we don't want anyone from the outside coming here. And you've got these refugee camps here, and this is the Fretland flag, so becoming very politicised and very, very strongly anti-government are some of these refugee camps. However, the way forward, I think, is to address some of those problems that I talked about in the way that the country was run by the first government, and we are starting to see a bit of that. Mr. Gujnal, the new Prime Minister who heads the coalition, has been splashing a fair bit of money around. He's talked about pensions for veterans, which is something the former government basically refused to adopt. Very sort of mean in their response to addressing those sort of demands. He's also given a lot of money around to people who can demonstrate a long service period in the resistance. And that may be fraught with some difficulties of transparency and corruption, but there is a sense that you need to get money circulating in this country, and that's really starting to happen. One of the things that now really a lot of visible evidence of, it's public works. And one of the problems of the first government was they had to set up this very elaborate procurement process. As I said, the ministers had to sign off on every little spending proposal, and that's now been fast-tracked. And this is interesting because given that someone has actually fallen twice down into the drains of Dili at night, because I it was dark, I didn't realise that there was a big hole in front of me. People have broken ankles and done all sorts of things. I was lucky. But they're now finally fixing up the footpath, which is very, very labour intensive. This is all happening. This is actually not far from Matadoro, actually, where this is. And so this is a good thing. And I think this is the sort of thing that they really need to do to get the country moving. However, I think some things will prove to be intractable. Getting people out of the refugee camps. You've now got, I mean, the estimates vary, but something in the order of 100,000 people who are these internally displaced refugees. That is, their houses have been burnt. They've now got to live in these camps, a bit like the one we saw just there. These are the UNHCR tents. And getting people to move back home is going to be very difficult. The first thing you need to do is to rebuild the security so people feel safe and also help people to rebuild their homes. But I think it's really a case of the government doing those basic things well, getting money flowing, spending on things that are worthwhile that actually help improve the country. I think it'll be a long while, though, before Timor gets back to where it was in 2006. And it's important to know what was achieved. I mean, in 2006, you had luxury cruise ships pulling up in Dili and Baucau, and people, well-heeled tourists from Australia and elsewhere, wandering around these places. It's hard to imagine now that you can do that. Freight companies like Intrepid Travel were booked solid. All these tour groups were all headed over there. All cancelled as a result of the crisis. You had 100 or so executives from senior companies at an investment conference at the end of 2005. So all of that has been blown away. But I think at the end of the day, if Timor can get a better system of government and heal this huge rift in the country, it will actually emerge from a better country, even though it's had to learn its lessons the hard way. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.